Have you made an honest review? Jump onto fifthwrist.com and read real takes by real owners about their watches. And of course, get involved and write about what's on your wrist. Fifthwrist.com is your independent space to talk watches.
Welcome to the Independent PQ Show from Fifth Wrist Radio. This is a place dedicated to showcasing the great people doing interesting things in the world of horology. My name is Roman, and today I am flying as a solo host. But that's less important because I've got a really cool guest. Now, this is a guest who's actually done the rare and possibly never before attempted guest, co-host, back to guest trifecta. Our guest is Mr. Ruben Scoots. G'day, Ruben. How are you going?
G'day, Roman. I'm really well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I was just reflecting on the shared history that you and I have, but also you have with the Fifth Wrist podcast. So we had you as a guest. I had to look it up. It was like 2 years ago. It was January 2021. For those listening, this is August 2023 now. So it's actually really exciting to touch base with you again, because since that time, you were just a fledgling little startup, and now you've taken over the world, obviously, but you still have time for little people like us, which is really nice. So it's a pleasure to welcome you back, mate.
Wow, that's over-profiling, but thank you.
No, it's really good. And for our listeners, if you haven't heard previous episodes, I'll put links into the show notes. But yeah, we did an episode with Ruben January 2021. And then Ruben actually came back as a co-host in our episode with Craig and Rebecca Struthers, which I think was in maybe August of 2021, maybe September, something like that.
Sounds good, right?
I'll put links into the show notes. So it's really, really cool. So really exciting to talk to you because I think you'll be – the stuff we'll talk about probably kind of will close off or maybe help build a little arc for people who are listening who are interested in independent watchmaking. Because you're kind of on this really interesting journey where when we met you in January 2021, you were just starting out kind of, sort of making watches under your name. Whereas now you're actually quite well along that process and, series one is done. You are going on to series two. So it's actually a really cool thing. I'm sort of keen to catch maybe some of your reflections along about the journey and kind of things you would do maybe different or advice you'd give people or whatever we end up talking about. So it's really cool. It's really, really cool. So lovely to have you. Maybe for those, once again, for our listeners who don't know, who didn't listen to the last episode, maybe give us a really short biographical note about yourself. Maybe, sort of how old you are, where you're based, how long you've been making watches. Look, don't worry about repeating the origin story of how you found horology. As I said, I'll put the show link in the notes. It's a really good story, really interesting story, how you found watchmaking as a thing after your illness. People can listen to it in the previous episode. But maybe just help people situate you kind of in the world, where you are, how old you are, how long you've been kind of making watches.
For sure. My name is Ruben Scoots, and I'm 30 years old, just turned 30. I began my journey in watchmaking in 2018. So this is my fifth year now. I'm based in Canberra, the capital of Australia, and I'm pursuing my dream of making handmade watches here in my workshop at home.
Amazing. Succinct. Beautifully said. Can't believe you're 30. This is like, I should screen people. I don't want to be ageist about this, but, I'm in my early 40s and, 30-year-olds, it's just, you're very well advanced in your life journey and kind of horological journey by 30. So well done you. Well done you, sir. All right. And Canberra, for those who don't know, Australia's most dynamic city, obviously, the hub of watchmaking in Australia. Definitely worth a visit if you like museums. Great museums in Canberra. So, and I actually, speaking of that, you and I met because I was lucky enough to visit your workshop, I think in maybe May last year, May 2022, I think. You were very kind enough to show me around and not kick me out or anything. So that was quite nice. Lovely. Lovely to see you there and see, series one watches in disassembled form just taking shape. It was very exciting. Very exciting. All right. Well, maybe Series 1 is probably a good place to start. So when you and I sort of talked about, when you and I talked in May, in January 2021, you were just starting to kind of crystallize the ideas for Series 1, for your first inaugural series of watches. Now, those watches are done now. So maybe tell us a little bit about what Series 1 ended up being, kind of, you know, what they were, you know, who they went to, without naming names, obviously, but, you know, kind of how long they took, kind of how you kicked off. Maybe let's do that.
When we spoke, I actually quickly re-listened to the episode because I was trying to orientate myself on just where I was and what was happening in that time. During that time, I was still doing antique clock repairs and restoration.
Yeah,
and I pivoted that business into conservation and was able to get some work with the Australian government.
Right.
And then I had the sort of the career goal for the clock work I really wanted to fulfill the dream of mine to be the watchmaker for the Commonwealth of Australia.
Right.
And fortunately there is a really beautiful long case clock in the Australian Parliament House that wasn't working. And they came knocking on my door, and that was a really wonderful final job for my antique clock conservation.
Oh, what a way to cap off that chapter. Wow.
Yeah, I was so pleased. I really couldn't believe that had happened, and it really put a moment in time, put a line in the sand where I knew I really wanted to move from doing clocks and watches, you know, making the Daniels Tourbillon watch and then doing the antique clock conservation. Mm. And I wanted to move into just making wristwatches.
Yeah.
That really was, it was just everything that inside of me, every cell of my body was just saying, just do it.
Yeah.
So we my wife and I made the decision and cut off the healthy income stream that was antique antique clock repair. Yeah. And as you know, Series 1 came too, and it was a time of a lot of uncertainty for me because, well, you know, I'm self-taught, and it really was the challenge to make wristwatches in whatever capacity, which just seemed, you know, tremendous.
Sure.
And during that time, you and I actually, we spoke a lot. And I'm very grateful for your mentorship and the advice that you shared during that time. Yeah, well, you know, I really was just, if in my world, you know, quite sheltered. I'm not a collector, and I'm not a, you know, at that point in time, at least I didn't really have much knowledge of the watchmaking industry as a whole. I just had a dream. And yeah, Series 1 was decided that I would make essentially as much of the watch as I could possibly manage. As something that's really important for me is actually making the parts. That's sort of where my interest really lies in the creation. Taking something from raw material into a finished part is quite magical. And I enjoy that. So the Series 1 watches ended up being 6 pieces. They were sold. They were all pre-sold, which was another, you know, super fortunate moment in time.
Absolutely.
4 of the watches were sold to collectors in Singapore, and 2 of the watches went to the United States.
Great. Okay. Interesting. So yeah, that's really cool. We'll circle back to that. That's really good. How long did it take? So how long did the 6 pieces take to make? Ballpark kind of thing.
It was roughly 18 months start to finish.
Right.
However, before that 18 months started, we moved into a new house, and then I set up the new workshop, which you visited. And then made the prototype. So all up, it was about 2 years. But actually making the 6 pieces themselves, it was 18 months.
Yeah. And for those, once again, and we'll link to your website, which actually has fantastic photography. It was another thing I was going to talk to you about. They're beautifully shot and shown watches, and I'll put a link in the thing. People should check them out. For those who haven't seen the watch, tell us what the Series 1 was, kind of in its conception, right? What did it look like? What did it have that was specifically yours? Because it's, I think it's worth talking about.
The Series 1 is a stainless steel, time-only, three-handed watch. Mm-hmm. Quite classically styled with a, a five-part dial. The plates, the bridges, and the cocks were all made of German silver, as was the dial and the chapter rings. Mm-hmm. The hands were hardened steel that were flame blued, and the dial itself had a finish that I've been going back and forth between calling hand flaked and hand scraped, which was inspired by the hand scraped finish that we see on really high end watchmaking machinery.
Right.
It is a finish that I really enjoy. It plays really well in the light, and I wanted to share. I really love these beautiful precision machines that we get to play with as watchmakers, and I wanted to share one aspect of those that I like most through the watches.
Yeah, lovely. Yeah, no, I think this is one of those things where the French language has the edge over English, you know, because in French it'd be like tremblage or something. You'll have a thing, you know, it won't be hand scraped. You'll be, I'm sure it's tremblage. Rob at Geneva Blue will correct me. He's our auteur of horological finishing techniques. You know, he will correct me, but hand tremblage.
Perfect.
No, that's lovely. No, it was, and the there's two things that I think worth touching, circling back. So one was about the hands. You sort of went with a purple colored. So they were heat blue, but they were purple in a very specific shade of purple. And just, I was literally talking to somebody maybe an hour ago, telling them that I was going to interview you. And the comment they wanted me to pass on was they love the color of the hands. And they mentioned another brand who I don't want to mention. We won't mention it, but they sort of said, you know, we can mention it off air. But what they were saying is, you know, the color that you chose, A, they asked me why you decided to do, they wanted me to ask you, sorry, why you went with heat purple rather than heat blued. And second part of that, they wanted to pass on the compliments that the purple, that the heat purpling that you've achieved is actually on par or better than the watches at a higher price bracket that have a similar. So that's not, I'm not blowing smoke into an orifice. This was genuinely a comment that was made literally an hour ago. So yay you. So question to you, I guess, why purple? And yeah, well done on the purple.
Oh, thank you. That's lovely feedback. I think that the flame purple mm-hmm. blue, shall we mm-hmm. call it, is mm-hmm. just such a superior color. I just like it. Right. Yeah, there's no real reason. I mean, it's more challenging to achieve than a blue.
That was going to be my question, right?
Only because it appears for a shorter amount of time. However, I just really like it. I also think it just goes really nicely with if you've got a silver, white, gold, stainless case, and with the German silver. There's something about those colors just go really nicely together.
Mm. The stability stays, so the color doesn't fade. Like it's just as stable as blue, you know, once you've achieved the color, like the heat purpling stays the same sort of thing.
Yeah, it does. All the way from, you know, when you first heat up the steel, it turns to a yellowy gold color, goes into a browny purple, into a dark purple, blue, light blue, onto gray. They all last as long.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Interesting. Yeah, because I've been sort of also reflecting, is not, once again, if we, the thing I remember you and I talking early on about, this was before you, or while you were thinking about kind of the concepts of Series 1 or just kind of thing, the piece of advice I often sort of talk about with people is, you know, if you make something, it needs to have something unique, you know, something of yourself that you can say, well, even if I don't make every part, and we'll talk about all the parts that you've made in a second, but you know, even if you don't make every part of the watch, the watch should reflect something specifically of yours. So I think I was really excited when, you know, when you found this dial finish, the hand tremblage, or whatever, sorry, we'll come up with the brand name pending of that. It was really unique. It was very much yours, you know, clearly kind of tapped into something of yours. And that kind of heat purpling is also good because that's now a combination that I associate with you, you know, and other people will as well. So I think just it's an important thing to think about for anyone else who's kind of thinking about starting on their thing. Design things are really important. Individuality is really important.
Yes. I was really stoked when it came to me. You know, it's sort of, you don't want to do something different for the sake of being different.
Sure.
But at the same time, yeah, you don't want to just make something that's identical to something else.
Sure.
I was really pleased. And it's a fun finish because it can be altered in so many ways. The geometry of the blade that you use to finish the dials can be changed. The sharpness of the blade can be changed. Yeah, the technique you use. So it really is sort of, I mean, that's just phase one of that finish, which is exciting.
Yeah, fantastic. And all six, I presume, because it's, do you do them one at a time? So all six are essentially unique, right? The dials will be slightly different.
Yeah, they're all done individually and they're all done by hand. So yeah. They are, yeah, of course, by nature, they're all different.
Fantastic. Very cool. So, like, lovely. So maybe tell us, before we move on to kind of where you're evolving to, in the series one, are you comfortable talking about the price, how much they sold for, ballpark?
Yeah,
great. And maybe tell us what you, like, which parts were made by you, which parts were, you know, adapted from other existing movements or Eboshes or whatever.
The series one, some were sold for $12,500 Australian, and some were sold for $15,000 Australian. The wheel train, the escapement, the winding works, and the case and the main plate were bought in.
Mm-hmm.
And then the parts that I made were all of the screws in the movement, the balance cock, the wheel train bridge, the barrel bridge, the click works, and the five-part dial and the three hands.
Yeah. Cool. No, it's really, really good. First of all, kudos on the transparency of the process. Once again, that was the thing I think maybe you and I talked about at the very start. Transparency, I think, is hugely important for all makers, but particularly for indie makers. And I think you've kind of struck that exact level of transparency, which then really connects to buyers, right? It's really cool. So I remember when I visited you in, must have been May of last year, May 2022. Yeah, I could see them all in trays, you know, being put together. It's the most delightful process. Like, just for me as a pure enthusiast to watch, like the joy on your face, the joy and the pride on your face was just brilliant. It was really, really brilliant to see. You know? And also very exciting to see that happening, not just in Australia, but in Canberra, you know, of all the dynamic places that could have been happening, Canberra's the place. you wouldn't necessarily pick as, you know, as the hub. But look, it's very.
I mean, you're really picking on us. So it seems like.
Look, some of my best watchmaker friends live in Canberra now.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, you know. No, it's very cool. Look, so maybe I wanted to talk about your workshop then and now, because I know it's really evolved and you've really. You know, when it wasn't exactly Dickensian, you know, you didn't have like a dog running around in the hearth powering the machines, but, you know, I mean, no disrespect to your Basenjis, but, you know, but no, you've really kind of gone on a whole new level now with the machines. Maybe let's talk about the buyers who found your watches, right? So your watches were pre-sold, which is amazing. Like, I think it's must be such a huge boost, like an ego boost, but also confirmation of the sleepless nights and the long hours are not in vain. How did that relationship come about with the buyers? Did they find you? Like, how did that relationship work?
It was quite an amazing process, really. all comes down to social media, right. Just sharing the process. It's always been something that I've tried to do, and it's not always so easy to share the process. There's so many trials and tribulations in watchmaking that it can be very difficult to actually know what to share. But I do my best, and it seemed to resonate with a few collectors who were just interested in seeing what I was doing. And I think a lot of my methods are probably a little bit outside the box, just given that I'm not traditionally trained, and that I'm, you know, a lot of my workshop, as you saw, is adapted for watchmaking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that somehow or another intrigued some collectors. And sure. Yeah, the relationship was formed purely via collectors seeing the content that I was sharing.
Mm. And you were quite relatively early on, like you were doing longer form YouTube videos. I mean, you were on Instagram, which is fine. I don't know if you're on any other platforms, because I'm not, so I don't follow you on anything else. But I remember you were doing the longer form YouTube videos, which was really brave in some ways, you know, because you don't, you know, because you were sort of showing it warts and all in some ways, you know, which is a really cool thing to see. Transparency again.
Yeah, those videos, they, the thought of releasing a video is, yeah, can be quite revealing in a way. You know, I feel like a lot of luxury goods has a lot of smoking mirrors in many ways. And
of course.
Yeah, which is, you know, that's all a part of that industry. However, I'm just really passionate about sharing, and I have not set aside the time that I wish I had to have continued sharing those long form videos.
Sure.
Yeah, seems to be the way. I mean, everyone that I enjoy watching on YouTube pretty much says the same thing. It's like, if only I had time.
Well, in some ways, it's kind of, I always like it when makers kind of disappear for a while. It means they're busy. Mm. You're making something, whether it's watches or guitars or leather bands or belts or something, you know, there's a common trajectory. You know, when people start out, there's a lot of, hi, it's me. This is my story. This is why I got into this craft kind of video. Then the next video will be like, this is my workshop. These are all my tools. You know, I'm very excited. And then if they disappear, that's great. It means they're just doing their thing, right? Eventually they'll pop, go, oh, you know, series one is done. Like, sort of like we're doing now. Or they go, you know, sorry guys, I've been away for a while, had a big order or something. It's good. Like, it means just, you know, you find your people and then you're busy making stuff. So yeah, that's good. So maybe let's talk about your workshop. So actually let's talk about, so series one completed, they're on the wrists of people now. One popped up for sale not too long ago. What's the emotions that the maker gets when a watch you've released out into the wild pops up for sale? Is it excitement? Is it trepidation? Is it hatred? Like, just generally, you know, what's the emotion inside? Be as honest as you care to be. No judgment here, by the way. So,
oh, it was a pretty crazy moment when I saw that the watch was up for sale.
Yeah,
it just, not because it's was wrong or was right or exciting. It was literally just a shock. It's something that I hadn't actually thought was a possibility.
Right.
I just hadn't thought about it. Hadn't gone that far in my thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just
too busy making. Yeah, you weren't planning on after sales. So,
and I found out. I think I was probably, out of all the people that saw the auction, I was probably like, I saw it maybe halfway through. You know, and then I had lots of people saying, "Oh yeah, I've been watching it. I saw it there." Okay, like news to me.
Yeah, great.
But yeah, it was a little bit. Yeah, there's some uncertainty, you know, just I think for the first time for anything, you don't really know, you know, what's going
to
happen.
That's why I'm really keen to, like, what's the emotion that goes through a maker? Because first time, that's right, first time on an open market, as it were.
Yeah, I think the open market is the best way to describe, you know, where I was sort of thinking. It's like, well, now the market is going to determine the value of my watch. There's no amount of sort of influence I can have on it, or I can't, you know, it's not selling to a collector who's become a friend or whatever. It's literally just whoever wants to pay the highest price gets the watch.
Yeah.
So safe to say the auction finished at, I think it was 3 or 4 a.m. Local time.
Wow.
And yeah, I didn't sleep much that night. I wasn't watching the auction, but I just I was just bidding, restless. Right? Yeah, I was just bidding.
Because it would be really stressful. I would imagine once again. Actually, what's your relationship like with objects once that you've made once they're done? Like, are you once it's done, it's in someone's hand, you move on to the next thing, or do you always kind of peripherally track where they are, you know, whether it's social media or something? Like, do you keep an eye on them, or is it like once done, it's somebody else's, you move on to the next thing? I'm always curious.
For sure, it's somewhere in the middle there. Like once they go and the, you know, the handover or whatever is complete, yeah, for sure, there's a huge release from my side, which is, you know, before that I was, you know, the last moment of having the watches in my possession was making sure that they kept time and were working. Yes.
Yeah, sure.
So they've been very closely monitored. And then when they leave, of course, there's a bit of space between, but yeah, I watch what they're all doing.
Okay.
Yeah,
interesting.
For sure.
No, it's really interesting. And the reason I'm asking is because I've asked the same question to a few makers now and I get quite different answers. And I think sometimes they're quite revealing about, you know, the makers' personalities. So, you know, I was chatting with, I remember we were lucky to have David Walter on the podcast. He's a great clockmaker and watchmaker, you know, born in Australia, but now lives in California in the States. And I remember he was saying, you know, that he, once it's over, you know, there's a tremendous sense of pride. This is done. But his stance was very much, this object really only exists because a buyer or somebody has commissioned it to happen. So he sort of helps to manifest it happening. And once it's done, it's very much, it's yours now, you know, treat it nicely. My work is done, which is good. So he's able to kind of put just kind of almost like a curtain. And I'm not putting words, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but my impression was, you know, it's very much like a curtain comes down, it's done, I move on to the next thing, which is, I think, a bit unusual because I think most makers, particularly watchmakers who spend so long, you know, 5 centimeters away from a movement for 6-12 months making stuff, just, I would imagine letting go would be very hard. Well, for me, it certainly would be quite hard to kind of just, you know, let go. So, yeah, interesting. Interesting.
That is interesting.
But the watch did very well. We should sort of just close the auction was, I think, Loop This was the platform, which I'm not super familiar with in terms of, I don't know, how the fee structures and all work. Do you remember what the final bid was? Was it 17 or 20? Sorry, we should have rehearsed this.
In US or Australian dollars?
US, yeah. Don't worry about conversions.
Yeah. Before buyer's fees, it was 26,000 US.
Right, okay. So for currency conversion and Aussie dollars, about 62 cents now or something, so people can do their own calculation. So that's good. So were you happy with the price, shocked with the price, or the price almost didn't matter as long as it sort of sold?
I was going to be happy with anything the same or higher than what it sold for.
Correct.
Originally.
Okay, good. Yeah, no, so yeah. I like an honest answer. So I think that would have been my kind of thing as well, right? As long as it sells for sales price, you know, retail price or above, yeah, you're fine. And we should say, you know, it's no issue with selling watches, I presume. I mean, I certainly don't have issues with people, you know, circumstances change and tastes change, or sometimes just people need to move an object on to finance the next purchase or the next commissioning of the next watch. So good luck with the buyer, good luck with the seller. Hope they enjoy it. It's just awesome to see. I mean, it was awesome to see you'd find a new home, I think is really the important thing. So, but no, would have been, yeah, I would imagine stressful night, hopefully a much better night.
No, it was just nice to have something to you know, to be so interested in, and yeah, we were so pleased. I mean, you know, I was so pleased with the results, and it was very fortunate how it turned out.
Look, that's awesome. So essentially you and Vincent van Gogh now have the same number of pieces sold at auction. So, you know, anything you do after this, it's all bonus. No, that's really cool. All right. Maybe let's talk about your workshop, because when you and I met, you know, the workshop was complete. You were making watches in your garage, in the sort of in the workshop that you've created in your garage, and it was really well laid out. And there was a video. There's a couple of YouTube videos that you made about setting up your workshop and kind of moving in and all that, so people can watch that. It's a really interesting stuff. How has the equipment setup changed since you and I met, or you know, new machines in? What did you find you needed to have now that you're an established maker? You know, what's the equipment evolution like for you as a maker?
I suppose there's a huge emphasis on quality.
Right.
You know, there's such a huge investment in time in making watch components to make them with anything less than the best quality machinery or tooling that you can possibly put together is just a waste of time, basically.
Right.
And there was a few hard lessons learnt from the making of Series 1. One of those was that I didn't have an ability to measure certain tolerances within the watch components.
Interesting.
And the only real way to measure is to make and then test for function. And so a huge investment was made in some optical measuring equipment, essentially a high-powered microscope and a very, very precise measuring machine that can connect to the computer.
Right.
And this enables very, very precise measurement and also an ability to compare the dimensions or the tolerances of the part that you've made with a 3D with a 2D drawing.
You're right, like an optical thing. Right?
Yep. Exactly. So you have your CAD file in the computer and you can directly compare that to the part. And this is just an enormous saving of time. Given that I work by myself in the workshop,
sure,
I'm looking for any opportunity to cut down on basically mistakes,
yeah,
or like I would say, like in quotations, like dumb work. It's just like
yeah, of course.
So that was a really nice upgrade since you've been, and then along with that, now I've got a full dedicated area in the workshop that is just dedicated to inspection. So, you know, a vast array of measuring equipment and just really trying to keep consistency and quality, to keep those two as high as possible. I'm not sure if when you came, I had my CNC milling machine, the one that I made.
I think when it was either just made, I remember we talked about it on the podcast when you were as a guest, and I remember you mentioned your mentor, I think it was Mr. Drabsch, I think is the engineer.
Yes, yes.
I can't remember his first name. Tony, maybe?
Lindsay.
Lindsay, sorry. Yeah, well, Lindsay, sorry, not Tony. But yeah, I remembered the more difficult last name. So I remember you were talking about that journey, you know, sort of that you had this engineering mentor and that you built a CNC, or you were building a CNC machine. So maybe tell us about that. Like, is that complete? I know it's complete because I've seen it on your social media account.
Yeah, absolutely. The machine was made twice, as it seems with all things that you make. The first iteration is never quite what you what you need.
Sure.
Or you discover what you need as you go.
Mm.
Yeah, that machine was made, and that was a really fun project. You know, to make a machine that would make watch parts, for me that pushed my buttons in a good way.
Sure.
And the machine made all of the parts that were made, all of the milled parts that were made for Series 1, not the lathe parts, obviously, but all of the milled parts were made on that CNC machine. So it sort of came full circle there. The machine, you know, was made, the prototype watch was made, and then it assisted with the making of the Series 1. And it was through using that machine with Series 1 that I sort of realized all of the things that, you know, if I could have a different machine, what would I want it to be?
Yeah.
And essentially just coming back to quality, was, you know, I wanted to be even more precise. Sure. But more importantly than precise is to be repeatable.
Of course. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So, you know, you can make, it's all well and good if you need six parts. If you can make 40 parts, and from the 40, you'll get six that are, you know, within tolerance.
Yeah, that match. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, yeah, that's how I did it. You know, the tolerances are very tight on a wristwatch scale, as you know, as I'm sure everyone listening knows.
Yeah, sure.
But they are very tight. And again, back to dumb work and, you know, wasting material, wasting time, wasting tools. It was sort of maybe halfway through the series one, I started to look for another solution, and that was to buy a professional watchmaking CNC machine. So that's brought into the workshop as well.
Yeah, wow.
Which is, yeah, really fantastic. It does everything that it's everything I need it to be, basically. And it just enables me to make parts that are more precise, more interesting geometry, and to a higher quality.
Mm. And for those who are sort of, I guess, who are listening to this, you know, just because you have a CNC machine doesn't mean you push a button and the part comes out and it slots right into the watch, right? Don't take my word, take Ruben's word for it. What happens once it comes out of the machine?
You just install it into the watch and it's just perfect.
You drop ship it straight from Guangzhou province.
No, it's CNC machining. You know, when I began on my journey, it was the Daniels method, which is, you know, handmade.
Sure.
However, you know, I believe that was, there's also, you know, a thing in for watchmaking, and that's watchmakers have always adopted modern technology, or if not, have been, you know, at the forefront or developing modern technology. And so that intrigued me to get into CNC machining. And then as I did start delving deep into CNC machining, I realized that, yeah, like you say, it's not pushing a button. It's a very, very involved process, and it enables you as a creator or as a watchmaker to make things to a quality, and also it enables you to create geometry that you simply just couldn't create without it. And that's really exciting. It is a really wonderful process. And I have a, you know, growing up, I was quite into computers, and I was always modifying my computer, trying to make it go faster. And
you're one of those kids, right? Gotcha.
Yeah, it's one of those. And yeah, I really, really enjoyed that. And then I, you know, as I got into my teens, my late teens, I got my license, I really got into cars. And cars have, you know, a computer. Well, modern fuel injected cars have a computer that controls them. And this is, you know, this is mechatronics, the mechanical and the electronical, the computer coming together. And I was always interested in tuning cars and modifying the computer and then modifying the mechanical components to, you know, achieve a car that was essentially faster. And CNC machining is very much in the same vein. It's a computer-controlled machine. And I love running a milling machine. I love running a lathe, you know, manual machines. And then when you add in the programming and the computer elements, it's sort of, for me, it's sparked in, it's sparked and joined, you know, old interests. So it's now my new obsession.
Yeah, because you do car racing as well, right?
I've been doing some amateur car racing, but I do hill climb racing.
Hill climb. So that's what I mean. Like, so you've got computers, you've got cars. If we can do some kind of timed milling races, that would be the thing to do. Like a timed competition, like make a part, put all the watchmakers in. How cool would that be? I think that would just tap in all your, you know, make this, whoever can do it fastest, from programming the CNC machine to hand finishing the final part. That would be awesome. I'd totally watch that. I mean, I'd fast forward a bit, but I'll totally watch that.
I mean, I'd compete in it and then watch it.
Yeah, but you're far gone. That's right. No, it's really interesting. I'm just, you know, you're really following the Daniels method from making watches to rebuilding cars. That's very much the, you know, the George Daniels, you know, started with watches and then half his life was restoring Bentleys. So, you know, you're very much in that path. The reason I'm asking is, I mean, the CNC machine, you're right. I mean, the main thing I would imagine it gives you is repeatability, because I think you can make anything by hand if you're only making one of something, right? Because it's always a prototype, right? Because you can always fix it and you can always throw the part out. You can always start again. You can draw it, sketch it. But if you need to do five of the same parts, it's that repeatability that takes time, right? So you can, if you're doing everything by hand, like, you know, let's say Grubel Forsey have that side project where they, I can't remember the thing, but, you know, they make those fully handmade from the ground up watches, the artisanal way, they can make one a year, right? Because that's that very much everything takes 50 times as long. And there's absolutely a place for that. But in a, even in a small manufacturer like yourself, where you're doing a small series, whether it's five pieces or 10 pieces, yeah, making everything from a plate of metal to the final product by hand, A, would take a long time, and the cost would be hugely significant, right? Yeah. Orders of magnitude more than...
Yes, than just crazy. I mean, it can't be underestimated, the amount of work that is involved, even if you were using CNC to make everything. Which I'm not, you know, because I simply don't have a CNC lathe. Mm. So I can't make, you know, all the little round pieces on the CNC machine. But right. It's, you know, when you're a one-man team, you've got design to deal with. Then you've got the actual machining process, you know, turning metal into parts. Then you've got the hand finishing process, and then to finish off, you've got the, you know, the adjusting and making sure that things are healthy and working. Mm. And the machining is one aspect where modern technology can really help, but the hand finishing process, the adjustment, and then the design is, well, really they're very, very time intensive parts of the watchmaking trade.
Yeah, and we haven't even mentioned the dealing with customer, well, dealing with potential collectors' inquiries, so, and the marketing in inverted commas, but, you know, your social media presence, maintaining that, responding to inquiries, dealing with customers. Yeah, like, I mean, that's, it's a lot to hang on one person, right? With a limited, because I presume time is always the limiting factor, right? You can always do more. You can always add things, but time is the limiting factor always.
Yeah, most certainly. Always try and squeeze more into the day, or work longer hours, and you do that long enough and you realize you're actually just, you know, going backwards anyway. So
absolutely. And then, you know, you're a family man, you know, like there are other parts of Ruben that need to have space, right, to exist, which is really important as well. You're at a really interesting point now, I think, because series one is done. You're in sort of series two, which we'll talk about now. Before we do that, one of the things I'm always finding really interesting is when do you find the time to start thinking about series two when you're so busy making series one and you've got orders in, you need to finish series one, but when do you have time to start thinking about the next thing? Like, when does that evolution happen? Do you know what I mean? Because it's not like you go, series one is done, like, you know, like the Ford Motor, Henry Ford, you know, they finished Model T and then they literally stopped the presses and they designed, I think it was the Model A or whatever, the, you know, the Edsel, whatever the thing was. But, you know, they kind of went, we stopped now, 6 months, there's no cars while we're designing the next model. You don't really get that luxury, right? Because you've always got to kind of roll on to the next thing. So when does the thinking about the second series happen while you're making the first series? Do you know what I mean? Am I crazy?
No, like, no. It's a good question. Time limited.
Yeah, just don't know where you find the time or the brain space to do that.
I throughout the making of the series one, everything that I wished I did differently, or, you know, maybe from a design perspective, I thought could be improved. I mean, it's all subjective, but, sure, you know, improvements in material selection, improvements in the balance of the dial, in proportions, in, you know, the architecture of the movements, etc. Right. I just had a folder on my phone a notebook in the workshop and a folder on the computer that I just would just dump into whenever came to me. I do a lot of thinking in the sauna. It's pretty well the only part of the day where I, you know, don't have a screen or a phone or or a watch in front of me. So it's a good time to think.
Okay.
But, you know, not too deep a thought is given, though. It's sort of just like, that bothers me, or I wish that was like that, or, oh, gee, I really like that material, you know, that, oh, look at that looks. Or, so I just, accumulated a big sort of dump of... mind dump of all of those things. And then once Series 1 was delivered, I mean, they were all delivered within the same week. I took a couple of weeks off, which was really required at that point. The last sort of couple of months of Series 1 was, you know, so that classic saying, like, the last 5% take 95% of the time,
sure,
plus brain space, energy, you know, difficulty, all those good things. I spent that time just modifying my car to make it go faster around a racetrack. And then once I was done with that, you know, I just wanted to work on something that I didn't have to measure, or, you know.
Yeah,
just,
much bigger tolerances, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, just nice to keep working with the hands. And, you know, as I said, I enjoy driving cars, so that was nice.
Sure.
And then after that, I sat down with the I had designed a prototype Series 2 watch.
Interesting.
And over the making of Series 1, you know, it's very limited time, but a very, very basic idea of what it was going to be, or what I wanted it to be.
Yeah.
I then sat down in the 3D modeling software and essentially started, you know, trying to solidify what it was actually going to be.
Right.
And I realized very quickly that my tastes and what I wanted it to be no longer were the same.
Interesting.
So I've scrapped the first iteration, shall we say, and started again. I sat down. It was probably another week or two getting the sort of basic movement architecture, the dial and the case. Then I scrapped it again. And then iteration three, it was a really simple change, but I really wanted to make the change. That was, I wanted to increase the size of the subsidiary seconds dial.
Okay.
I really wanted it to be bigger, and I really wanted it to be in a slightly different spot on the dial.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't sound like that big of a change, and I guess in the scheme of things, it's not, but it did mean that I had to move the position of all of the wheels in the watch, which, you know, when you've designed the architecture of the movement, it's a little bit problematic. That means you've got to move the mainspring, the winding works, the escapement. So I set about doing that, and then I thought, you know, it was that classic thing where you're sort of, I don't know, I can't think of the saying right now, but when you're basically changing something so much, it's like, why don't you just start again? So I did, and it was a really good decision, because the evolution from, I'll share with you some 3D models, basically, of the evolution from that number two, number three, and then when I actually changed the entire movement, and it's entirely different. And I knew that was Series 2 when I saw it, because it made me really excited.
Right.
It was something I looked at and I thought, oh, I really want to make that. So that's when it was sort of decided that's what it is. And now it's time to, you know, get cracking.
Yeah. So do you think so what was the takeaway message then for yourself for Series 3? Will it be design the dial first? Did you feel that you had to go through this process, and this is now the Ruben process? You start with an idea and you know that the first two or three might not nail it, but by the time do you think you go, no, next time I go, I'm going to make sure I get this right before I do anything else. I'm going to get the dial right, or whatever, the architecture of the movement right. Like, do you think that will, what you've gone through for Series 2, do you think will that change how you do things for Series 3, 4, 5?
Most certainly. I hope that process improves, you know, every time.
Okay.
But for sure, it's no real secret that the dial must be solidified and designed first. Everything else needs to revolve around that. I mean, that's written in George's book, Watchmaking. you know, don't bother, you know,
fiddling with the movement.
More eloquently written, but don't bother with anything. Start with a dial, because that decides where your wheels are going to be planted. It decides, it determines everything, basically. And yeah, I know this, I knew this, but I really wanted to make that change to the dial because I felt that the, I just had this necessity to make that subsidiary seconds dial bigger.
I mean, the reason I'm asking is because, you know, I'm really interested in art, as, you know, another one of sort of my interests is art. And there is this theory in art about there's two types of artists, broadly speaking. There's the conceptual artists versus experimental artists. So conceptual artists tend to be artists who become famous very young because they kind of come forth with a clear idea, like somebody like Picasso, for example. You know, he's 19, he's 20, he comes out with something, it just captures, he knows exactly what he wants to say, and it's on the canvas. You know, and you get somebody, and then the opposite to that would be, I don't know, somebody like Cezanne or Matisse, you know, never happy. It's always 50, there's 50 drafts and there's 50 versions and never satisfied. Even when the painting is finished, still never satisfied. You know, always tinkers, doesn't quite know what the idea is. It's the making is the process, as opposed to I know exactly what I'm doing, I have a clear idea I'm going for. So I'm kind of always interested in how watchmakers or other artists in a way kind of arrive at their thing that they do. So anyway, hope that's, other people find it interesting, I do. Anyway.
Well, it is very interesting. I mean, I suppose if there was no, it's so difficult to know when to put, you know, when is the line in the sand, you know, because you could just go on prototyping forever, like
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, when you said like you just knew, you know, it was one of those, you put the brush down and go, yeah, there she is, or there he is, it is, whatever the, I don't know if you anthropomorphize your designs or not, I don't know, that's a personal question. But, you know, you go, there it is, nothing else needs to be done. Like that must be a very powerful moment where you go, that worm that's been eating at you, you go, oh, I need to move this. You go, actually, no, it's done. That's exactly what I wanted it to be, or what I want it to be. So, good. So are you able to tell us what series two will be like and where you are in that kind of process of making, or allowing people to pre-order, or like what's the, you know, where are you on the arc of making series two now?
Yeah, the series two, I'm right in the middle of machining the components for the movement.
Yeah, it's coming on. So what is it? So what will it be?
The series two is quite a significant evolution on series one. Yeah. I should probably explain sort of my the path that I'm sort of taking with the different series. And that is, it's really important for me, just based on my interests, that as much of the watch as possible is made by me in my workshop.
Right.
Because that's what interests me. That's why I started this. That's where the dream came from. And so the series two is an evolution on series one in that I hope that everything overall about the watch is going to be improved, whether that be aesthetics, balance, material selection, overall quality, etc. But also including the most notable things that I'll be making that I didn't for series one is the main plate and the case.
Wow.
More movement components as well. But most notably, the sort of the two big challenges that I wanted series two to, that I wanted to, overcome through series two, is the case and the main plate.
Wow.
So the watch itself is, none of the components in the movement that I'm making are the same as series one.
Okay.
Everything is completely new in terms of its, 3D geometry. I've tried to really emphasize making intriguing geometry with the watch. I really wanted something that's sort of interesting to look at. I am really obsessed with looking at watch movements. There's something about looking at the wheels and everything together, but particularly the way the wheel train is laid out and the architecture of the bridges and the cocks. There's something about that sort of that world of mechanism that really I really enjoy.
Sure.
So I spent a long time, basically making that as much to my liking as I possibly could. The watch is going to be 18,000 vibrations per hour.
Mm-hmm.
As the Series 1, it's going to have frosted finish for the plates and bridges,
mm-hmm.
Just a finishing technique that I really like.
Yeah, the Scooch tremblage, yeah.
Great. Yeah. Yeah. The winding wheel is going to have a beryllium copper cap, okay. which is an interesting material. It's sort of, for those who aren't familiar, it's a copper rose gold appearance. It's quite a good bearing material, so it's suitable for the job, but really the aesthetic quality for me is it's just beautiful, and I think it goes really nicely with the German silver. The center wheel is now in the Series 1, the center wheel jewel was a part of the barrel bridge. It's now separate to the barrel bridge. It's its own standalone steel cock.
Right.
And in the Daniel's style as well. Just another aesthetic choice that I really enjoy. And then, yeah, there's a whole array of differences between the two, but a photo of the prototype, which is now nearing completion. The render would be more suitable than using my words.
So still a three-hander?
Still a three-hander, still with subsidiary seconds.
Yeah.
Quite some similarities between the dials in terms of, you know, classically styled with chapter rings and nameplates and three-hander.
Yeah.
The material choice for the dial, Series 1 was German silver.
Mm-hmm.
And for this dial, I really wanted to enhance the legibility, the overall aesthetic quality, but the legibility and also the contrast. So the dial will be made of silver,
mm-hmm.
Which is brighter, whiter than the German silver. It also allows you to play with things like bleaching. So dial can be made quite white, which like is...
my Shapiro sort of style, yeah.
Exactly, which I really think is lovely. And I do think it's nice to have a bit of contrast between the dial backing, shall we say, and the chapter rings themselves.
Yeah.
The subsidiary seconds dial is going to be slightly larger. There is very minor changes to the hands and very minor changes to the numerals, the engravings.
Sure.
But the hand finishing technique is going to be the scraped finishing technique.
Yeah.
However, it has been the tool and the tool has been changed, and the method has been changed as well, just for a difference.
Yeah, well, it's evolving, finishing. I guess. Yeah.
An evolution.
I was going to say. So, do you think that sort of the scraping tremblage thing? Do you see that as being kind of the hallmark that will tie the designs together for all the future things as well? Like, do you see it as kind of a hallmark Rubens style sort of thing, or is it too early to talk about? Sorry, I keep pushing for that.
No, I really like it.
I'm a big fan as well.
It's not something that has to be only featured on the dial, for example. Sure. I mean, if the dial was going to be with a different finish, it might be frosted, or it might be with guilloche, or what have you. But that hand scraping technique can for sure be applied within the movements.
It could be
applied on the case as well if you really wanted. For now, I feel like the Series 1 with that finish was sort of the first iteration. And there are a couple of different sort of aesthetic finishes that you can achieve with that finish that I would like to explore.
Yeah, that's great. For sure. I think that's awesome. That's really cool. How many do you envisage making of the Series 2? What's the time frame, ballpark kind of thing? You know, just for people listening, when will designs be available for people to look at? That kind of stuff. you know, if somebody's listening to now, series one is gone, so sold out, unless you can hassle the six original owners or five plus the new owner, track them down. You know, give us a bit of a idea of where you think you're tracking time-wise on these.
The watches will be delivered next year.
Yeah, wow.
That's the goal.
Yeah, I like how you said next year and not without putting the numbers in, because that's a classic Canberra politician trick. Everything's next year, so that's always relevant, because whenever you listen to it, next year is always. I'm joking, obviously. You can see I spend a bit of my time talking to politicians in my non-watch career, so
it would seem
I'm very attuned to the next year commitment. We're firmly committed to next year.
We're firmly committed to something in the future.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, brighter, better. No, that's, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, it's you know, been very fortunate to work with clients who completely understand that you know, I don't want, nor do they want, a sacrifice on the quality of the product. So if things take longer because they need to, they do. But yeah, how things are tracking right now, the watches will be delivered next year. Did you ask?
Yeah, do you envisage like a limited series? Like, what's your vision? Is it going to be six again? Do you think you'd make more? Is it an open series in some way? Kind of, what are you thinking at the at this moment? And I know things evolve, so we're not, you know, nothing's set in stone. How are you thinking about that?
At this stage, I haven't been too fussed to make a limited series.
Yep.
Because I truly believe that, you know, collectors who are interested and who know, you know, how the watches are made and by who, by the nature of my work, it is a limited series.
Yes, yeah, time. Yeah, you are limited. You are the limiting resource. That's right.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's, yeah, numbers are going to be very low, just given the nature of the work.
Sure. But you're not sort of setting out as, you know, only 10 will be made and then we move on to something. It's like,
no.
Yeah, right. Available for people to look at designs now?
Yeah, absolutely. We're actually just putting together a brochure.
Yep.
Which will have, you know, provide those all interested with
sure.
all relevant details and some, you know, I've been teaching myself 3D design and making renders, which has proved to be a very valuable skill just for myself, actually, to be able to see a part before you bother actually, you know, putting a cutting tool into a material,
sure,
which has been really good. So, yeah, that brochure will be available probably by the time this podcast is published.
Well, yeah, and so, we'll link it up, whenever if it's on your website or something, we will link it up to that, of course, sort of thing. That's very exciting. That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been great.
I'm super excited for you, like really, really excited for you. I'm just trying to picture I hope the guys or girls, whoever has the series ones, I wonder if they're getting the series, will end up getting a series two, because it'll be something really magical seeing the two side by side. Like, you know, the evolution, I would imagine, would be really, really quite startling.
Yeah, I mean, we're pushing for the evolution to be startling.
That's great. Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome.
Yeah. But, you know, we were fortunate enough with the Series 2 to have some pieces pre-sold before, you know, officially sort of releasing the series.
Series 1, you mean, or Series 2?
Series 2.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, fantastic. All right, so Series 2, a few pieces are pre-sold already.
Yeah.
Oh, so, amazing. Oh, congratulations. That's really exciting.
So that's been another sort of blown away moment where
amazing.
You know, people are so willing to believe in my work and what I'm doing that you know, before seeing anything, people are willing to you know, buy in, which is
wonderful,
truly humbling.
Yeah, it's wonderful, but I think it's both a testament to your work that now that people buy in, but also I think it's a testament to the better educated or more passionate collector base that are actually now starting to appreciate the skill, the time, the investment and the commitment that you put into your work, you know, and that they're prepared to sort of go, you've delivered series one, we like where the journey is going, you're clearly passionate and committed to this thing. And it's lovely to get patronage like that. I would imagine it would be a huge financial support to get stuff rolling, materials and all that, but just as moral support and reassurance and kind of reinforcement of your own desire to make stuff when you've got people willing to support you in that way.
Yeah, most definitely.
So well done, whoever's doing that out there. You know, tribute, yeah, we salute you, whatever the, you know, the Roman, you know, centurion stuff is. That's really cool. That's lovely. And I agree with you in terms of the time, you know, it takes what it takes. Sure, absolutely. I think I would imagine the sort of collectors who buy into your watches, yours is not their first watch and probably not their second watch, right? So often they'll tend to be quite familiar with that process of, you know, sometimes it takes longer and it's in the owner's interest. It's in the customer's interests for the watch to take as long as it needs to take, you know, for you to kind of, you're not going to hand it over unless it's exactly like you want it to be and like it needs to be.
No, absolutely not. And I should probably add to that I will not sell so many watches that it will delay delivery by some astronomical amount of time.
Right.
I'm not interested in that either.
Right. Okay. Sure.
You don't want to be making the same thing for the next 10 years. So.
Yeah. Do you envisage making them all and then delivering them all together like you did with series one? Or do you think you'd kind of be doing a stepped delivery for series two?
Yeah. It most likely will be a stepped delivery.
Right.
Yeah. It makes the most sense. As the watches, you know, as I'm making more of the watch and, you know, just again, pushing the quality as much as possible, it makes the most sense to actually just focus on the one watch at a time.
Sure. Yes. Sure.
Give it your undivided attention. And, you know, with the six from the series one, it was, you know, always keeping track in a notebook, in a spreadsheet, trying to keep track of where every watch is at because you think you remember, but, sure. You know, it's, one tiny little mistake. You think you're doing one thing to one watch and you do it to another and doesn't work.
Wow. Oh, that's very cool. It's very exciting to hear. I said, like, it's just we're catching this really interesting trajectory where you kind of sort of, yeah, it's so exciting to hear how much work and how much has happened since in the last 2 years or, you know, when we met you. Just the machines you've made, the you've made literally and acquired and, you know, upskilled your workshop. The kind of the commitment you've put into kind of learning new skills and, you know, programming and rendering and all that. And just, yeah, it's amazing how much stuff can happen in 2 years and so exciting to see and hear your growth. I think probably last question. I remember when I asked you in January, would you ever work with other people? Would you take other people on? You're like, no, you were very much, I'm happiest on my own. I've got, you know, dogs and my wife if I need company, but otherwise I'm very much happy on my own. That's still the case. Don't want helpers, interns, you know, watchmaking students, whatever the proper term is, I don't know, proteges and all of that. Still happy on your own?
Yeah, I'm really happy working on my own. I do really enjoy it, and you know, there's a huge amount of freedom when you're working by yourself, that you know, not managing other people's time or skills. Right. However, the idea to build a team, that does excite me. So I'm not against it in any way, but right now it's not something that's really on the cards for me. I'm very, very content with doing the work that I'm doing, and you know, I'm one of the fortunate few that is actually doing exactly what they would like to do. And that's something that, you know, for me, that often makes me quite emotional in a way. It's like, it's, you know, what did I do to deserve this, you know? So That's really lovely. And I don't necessarily want to just give that away either.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I'm always interested once again in this because there is a common watch, independent watchmaking trajectories, you know. You start with one guy or girl, for that matter. You know, you start as one person. You make your watches, you're happiest making the thing, and then you get more orders in. You eventually get more people in to help you make the orders, and then next thing you know, you're actually not making the watches, you're managing the people. And, you know, which is not always the skill base you have because you got into the game making watches, not managing watchmakers. So, you got to do what works. So I'm glad you're in a great place, and sounds like I can tell by the smile on your face you are in a good place. That's awesome. I'm super, super happy for you. So look, Ruben, I guess the last question would be, how do you maintain work-life balance? You know, you're a watchmaker, which is a very obsessive, time-intensive work. Your workshop is also at home, so it's a very short commute. It's not like you have time to just, you know, go and de-stress on your way home or plan your next day. How do you maintain? When do you know it's time to put the tools down?
It's a really good question. It's not always easy to know when to stop, particularly when you feel like the end of something is just in sight, or when you're tired at the end of a day. I mean, we all know what that's like, and you're often not thinking super clearly, and sometimes I will become quite obsessive and just want to keep working, and to sort of be like, well, now's dinner time, or now's time for other things, being with my family or whatever. And sometimes it can be really hard to let go. But I'm pretty regularly reminded by, if you keep that up for a period of time, there comes a time where you actually just become so useless. Your effectiveness in the workshop is pales in comparison to what it would be if you were, working an acceptable work day for, everyone's different. Some people can work big days, some people can't. But for me, really the most important thing is sleep. That's like, it all just comes down to how much you've actually slept at night. If you get a great night's sleep where you can work the whole day, no worries. Sun up to sundown. But if you get a crappy sleep, well no. But I suppose it's something that I'll by no means will say that's something I've mastered. I will very happily let my obsession get the better of me. It's sort of my happy place in my mind, thinking about watchmaking. So it can be hard to turn that off.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's one of those things where I think, not just in watchmaking, I certainly learned that about myself during lockdowns. We were in Melbourne, we were locked down for a long time, so everyone had to work from home. And we also had to do, homeschooling for children, and working from home for me was not great because I found I get very much involved with my work. Not podcasting is not a real job, but my outside actual work, there's always, if you work from home, the temptation is always, I'll just do this little bit. There's always another email to write. I'll just finish this. And I found myself, ended up working crazy stupid hours. I would work, 7 a.m. till, 11, where you'd, have dinner and then put my son to bed, and then I'd come back and work just because the work is sort of there. And you sort of get to a burnout period. Well, I'm not sure how other people find it. So I have to sort of remind myself, at some point it's like tools down. It has to. My work's, but sometimes you're right. You get into this flow state. Sometimes things are going really well. It is much harder to put work down if you feel you're kind of in the groove. But then, I guess you have to remember there's other demands on your time, which are not just work, right? There's family, the social obligations, whatever the thing is that rounds you as a human and allows you to work. It's just an important thing for people to remember, So it's cool. I'm glad you found your you're in the right Zen area, now. So, but it's always work in progress. But Yeah, I'm always, you know, the kind of the obsessional artist that we tend to sometimes associate, you know, with this kind of, you know, oh, they must be always working. Those people must be, awful to live with. You know what I mean? I would imagine a single-minded person who's committed to their craft or to their art or to the thing, to the exclusion of everything else, would be awful to work, to live with, or just interact with, right?
Certainly. You know, it's already a relatively, or maybe not even relatively, it's a selfish.
It's an all-consuming thing. Yeah,
it's a very selfish journey to be on. You know, in the capacity that I'm, you know, going through this journey. Yeah, it's a lot of sacrifice made by, you know, particularly from my wife and my immediate family. It's like, for sure, there's lots of times where, you know, I won't be present because I'm thinking about something else. Or
yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. You're still focusing on the CNC machine in the other room.
For sure.
The
workshop. But yeah, also, you know, really well aware that, you know, I'm always just, you know, almost everyone that you talk to is, you know, over 80 years old, always says the same thing. It's life goes so quick. You know, it's like, okay, like this. Yeah. I do try and remember that, you know, and just flirt a little bit with the angel of death every now and then, and just,
Memento mori. Well, watchmakers, I would imagine, are always reminded of the fleetingness of time while they're expending endless hours crafting watches, right? That must be quite a mind trip, I would imagine.
Yeah, I still haven't worked that one out yet. Spending time trying to keep time, I don't know.
Neither of us are drunk or high enough to really explore that mind rabbit hole. But look, it's really, I'm glad we sat down to chat. I am so excited, and I hope our listeners are as well, like to follow you on this journey now from 2021 and kind of follow you where you started finding, you know, you've got this really amazing way that you discovered watchmaking when you were at a really low point in your life with your health, to kind of then get to a place where you are now, where you're making watches, you've got a real pathway ahead of you, and you are achieving so much. It's just wonderful to hear. So thank you. Thank you for spending the time. I know you could be doing other things. You could be on the CNC machine right now or with your wife, but you're with us. So we do appreciate that. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, being so open about, you know, the process, what it's taken and what it is taking to get to where you are now and where you're going. So thanks so much, Ruben. Been a real pleasure to talk to you, mate.
Thank you so much, Roman. Truly. It's I appreciate it so much to be able to come here and have a chat with you. You know, we chat offline as well, but it's really nice to be able to to do it here. So thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure, man. Absolutely. And for everyone listening, make sure you check out Ruben's social media or Instagram, and the website's your Instagram is Rubens at RubensScoots and at RubensScoots.com. Definitely check out Ruben's website. Beautiful photography of Series 1. By the time this episode comes out, there'll be info about Series 2 on there as well. And definitely get in touch with Ruben. Check the watches out. Really, really cool. Thank you for joining us. Thanks for spending the time with us at the expense of other things you could be doing. As we always say when we finish up, stay on time.
Fifth Wrist is by the community for the community. We would love you to join the crew via our group chat on Slack. Email us at contact@fifthwrist.com and join the movement.